in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, bringing the world closer to home through performances by Camerata Sweden, the Afro-Latin Jazz Orchestra, Israeli singer Shava Alberstein, Laura Fuentes y Calicanto from South America, and A Scottish Christmas with fiddler Bonnie Rideout. For more information, contact the Krannert Center ticket office at 217-333-6280 or visit krannertcenter.com.
It's 6 minutes past 1 o'clock. Today, the afternoon magazine features an interview from the AM 580 archives. Since it's a recorded interview, we won't be taking phone calls this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Our guest today is the National Affairs Correspondent for The Nation. Journalist William Greider is the author of 7 books. His latest is The Soul of Capitalism, Opening Paths to a Moral Economy. That's what we'll talk with him about this afternoon. In this book, Greider looks at, on the one hand, the success of American capitalism in the 20th century. He says, we've solved the elemental problems that have plagued humanity for millennia, hunger and scarcity. But on the other hand, he sees a problem with our success, dysfunction and alienation. He says we now need to learn how to live amid endless plenty and, ironically, how to live well in spite of it. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. William Greider has been a reporter for 40 years. He's worked for The Washington Post and Rolling Stone. He's also been a correspondent for the PBS series Frontline. His previous books include One World, Ready or Not, that on the global economy, Who Will Tell the American People, that on American politics, and Secrets of the Temple on the Federal Reserve. His new book, The Soul of Capitalism, is published by Simon & Schuster. Mr. Greider, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste. I should add, my first newspaper job a million years ago after I got out of the Army was in Wheaton, Illinois.
Really?
The now-defunct Wheaton Daily Journal, and met my future wife there. So I have roots.
Oh, well, welcome back to Illinois,
if only
by a long-distance telephone call. This afternoon. Two questions here at the outset, the obvious ones. Number one, I'm sure people listening to my introduction might be saying, well, really, have we really solved the problem of want? And why do we then, as you put it in the book, keep on like a long-distance runner who's won the race yet keeps running beyond the finish line?
Well, obviously, there are millions of Americans whose the problem of want is quite real and daily and sometimes desperate. But that seems to me part of what we need to step back and examine. You could make an argument justifying a lot of inequities 100 years ago, 150 years ago, maybe even more recently. But when a country is as wealthy as ours and allegedly as productive as ours, one has to ask, why do we have this sort of permanent lumpen minority of really desperately poor people? And it's bigger than that. Why are so many millions of people who have a job, maybe even a pretty good job, work quite hard, find themselves kind of on the treadmill, working longer, squeezing the other elements of their life in order just to keep up with what they regard as a fairly modest standard of living? Mm-hmm. That's part of what my book tries to get into.
Yeah. Go ahead.
More generally, I don't think Americans need another book to tell them how the economic system abuses them in various ways. Mm. I mean, there have been a good number of very good books about that, and there will be more, I'm sure. What I'm trying to get at is the system itself. How does American capitalism function in such a way that it really replicates the inequalities and even expands them from generation to generation, even as it produces so much abundance, and what explains why family life is squeezed, why people feel confined. The other problems of doing damage, and I think quite serious damage to the natural world, the environment, in ways which we know have pretty serious implications for the future, not next year or the year after, but down the road a ways, something's got to change. So that and a whole bunch of other stuff I'm trying to approach systematically rather than waving the flag, trying to awake people to the realities. I think people know the realities.
Mm, yeah. Let's talk with a listener who is joining us this afternoon from Chicago on the toll-free line. Good afternoon.
Hello. I'm so pleased to be able to speak to Mr. Grader because in one of your books, I think it was Who Will Tell the People, you had a line, and it was a case of where the truth just resonated in the heart. And unfortunately, I don't understand why no one else ever talks about it. But in that book, you said the public feels that politicians are lower than used car salesmen, but no one ever talks about the absolute disregard that politicians have for the public.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not, that wasn't a direct quote, but that was the sense of what you said.
Yeah, I know, I remember what you're talking about. It was the,
that explains,
I said something like the contempt is mutual.
Yes.
And of course, that's not true of every politician, but and let me say first off, I know a lot of politicians. I've known them for years. Many of them are noble characters, no question. But on the whole, they get bombarded, and they develop a kind of distance of their own, just as people withdraw from politics. Many politicians literally withdraw from the people they're supposedly representing.
But I think the reason why that resonates so much is because so many policies that come out of Washington that seem to have total disregard for us, or so many information that comes out that seems to strain credulity, can only be explained by that statement. And so I want to thank you for that, because when I wonder what are they thinking, I always remember that line.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Well, have you talked with people in political life about the soul of capitalism and a more moral economy?
You know, I haven't much yet. The book is new, and I got a bunch of, I've been around Washington a long time. I know a lot of people, and I got some calls from different offices saying they wanted to see a copy. And I said, well, you should know this book is not really about you. It's about the other half of our realm, which is capitalism itself, and by that I mean the enterprise, business, finance, the whole system that we live with. And I try to explain in the book that Americans really dwell within two different value systems, and we are responsible to both, or at least we respond to both in different ways. One is what I think are the operating values and premises of business and finance, capitalism, and the other is a sort of the human society. And when I say moral, I really mean not the narrow business ethics questions, but the kind of moral obligations and interests we all have as human beings, whether it's raising children or being responsible to the future, to the past. Knowing the difference between right and wrong. There's a long list in the book, which is just for instances for people to understand that in these two realms, they collide because they do frequently, fundamentally, have different values. And so I'm making an argument that if society wishes to nurture and protect its own personal human moral values, it's got to change the capitalist system, which often tramples them.
Yeah, and you argue for a social definition of more.
Yes, and I think, some people would misread this as I'm a no-growth character who wants the economy to stop cold. That's not at all what I mean. What I do mean is that we have to ask more of what. And the simple example for people is, the way things work now and the way incomes are decided up and down the ladder, Americans are working 300 to 400 hours longer every year than their counterparts in other industrial, advanced industrial societies like Western Europe, Japan. To me, that's a stunning fact, because you do ask, well, if we're so wealthy, why is this so? And you can go into all of the particular settings of the economy and find the answers, of course. One of the answers is that both the control and the daily decision making in business enterprise, and especially in capital finance, are pretty closely held. Decisions are made by a relatively few number of people, and people in big companies and sometimes in small companies know this to be so. And I suggest, for instance, if there were a way to spread out the capacity for decision-making laterally, that is, have more people with voice and at least a chance to say what they think the right route is, we would not have that. Because I think, now people could prove me wrong, but I think most people would say, well, we're trading our lives for another couple shifts of production. And what do we really gain by that when it becomes so confining to meet our goals for production at the expense of our families or our just our ability to absorb and enjoy and honor all the other elements in life? That's a kind of abstract proposition, but I encountered people all over this country, and not just working class in the factories, not just the working poor, but way up the line, who were expressing that quandary. I don't say that it's universal, because obviously some people don't experience it, but it's pretty widespread in this society right now, and I'm trying to suggest some answers.
Let's talk with another listener now. Line 2, caller in Charleston. Good afternoon.
Hello. I'm interested in hearing your answers as well, and would like to pose a perspective and then ask what you think we should do about it. But there are a couple of things that I'm concerned about, and one of them is the extreme increasing inequity of distribution of wealth in our country. And it seems to me that our country and society was built on the fact that everybody had a chance to have a piece of the pie, and therefore we weren't fighting each other and doing all those things just to survive. And it seems like more and more people are getting bigger and bigger pieces of pie at the expense of others getting a smaller piece. And I'm concerned about how it's going to affect our whole country as a whole. And the other thing that concerns me is you keep talking about people working. There are lots and lots of people, because I, in my job, work with them daily, who are eager, willing, and ready to work, and there are no jobs. And that kind of scares me right at this moment, that we have a high number of people who want to work and who can't for lots of reasons. And I'm wondering what you would like to comment on in the way of redefining what work is. It kind of gets back to what you were saying earlier. Maybe it's not the number of hours we put in, but maybe more task-oriented rather than punch-clock-oriented. But I think part of the solution in us being able to handle this rather large transition we're going through here is being able to successfully redefine what work is and how that compensation is going to be handled more equitably. Would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, I love that question. In fact, that's a central element of my book, is trying to explain first why the system produces the results it does now, and then showing some ways out of the corner. The first thing to understand that in the organization of our employment system, with some notable exceptions, but for the most part, we still have a kind of feudal remnant in our lives. And that is, to put it bluntly, the master-servant relationship. Somebody is the lord of the manor, and maybe a collection of people, and everybody else has at least the status of serfs in terms of rights. Now, we're not serfs, obviously, in the medieval sense. But in terms of the ability to participate in decisions, to claim a reasonable, fair share of the returns, that's about right. And I know that sounds harsh to people, but I've tried it out for years on just anybody. We were in conversation. I'm yet to encounter somebody who just says, oh, that's flat wrong. And most, after a bit of mulling, agree, yeah, it is a master-servant relationship. Since the book has come out just a few days ago, I got an email from a business professor on the West Coast who said he and his fellow faculty members have been exploring a very similar question, collecting discussions and examples and so forth, because they've all had professional experience, and they asked that question of business school grad students, all of whom were working professionals. Is this true, a master-servant relationship? And he said the results are unanimous. Now, what I'm getting at is that until we're willing to re-examine that and ask, does it have to be that way, the system is sure, or nearly sure, to replicate this inequality and enlarge it generation after generation. If a firm was organized in a more democratic manner, whether as like a partnership, which lawyers and other professionals have, or like an employee-owned company, of which there are, 10 or 12,000 around the country, or some hybrid cooperative variation on those, and everybody at least had voice in, okay, how are the returns going to be distributed? Can anybody imagine the workers generally, all employees, producing the scale we have now? I don't think so. And they would argue over it endlessly, no doubt, but you would get at least a greater degree of equity in the rewards at the pay window. In some ways, more important, the shared ownership of the enterprise means both shared responsibility, shared risks, and a share of the returns, that is, the profits that are accumulated by the work of all the people in the firm, and that seems equitable, too. My argument in the book is that the company as we know it, generally, is a principal engine of the inequality in our society. And I'm for government ameliorative programs, and always will be, but there is no way on earth the government can overcome the distribution, the maldistribution, that goes on every day in the economy itself.
What do you think the future of labor is? Organized labor.
Organized labor?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's in a really, and I discuss it some in the book, not in any thorough, overarching way, but organized labor, believe it or not, is in the vanguard on some of these questions. You don't read about it in the newspapers, and frankly, they don't talk about it as much as they ought to. And it's certainly not universal within organized labor. But some labor leaders, both local and national level, see this problem as I'm describing it. They use different words, maybe, but they understand the reality of being cut off and put in a permanently subordinate position, particularly in firms that are in trouble. So steel workers, machinists, paper makers, some auto workers have done some, have all participated in what amount to worker takeovers of a company that's in trouble, or have invited the managers and owners to share the ownership in some degree and create a less authoritarian system and a more participatory one. What people in those experiments know is that if you do it conscientiously, it makes the firm more effective.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think of the logic of that, it's pretty obvious. If you own a share of the company and you do have a stake in the profit balance, you are likely to be more productive, as one worker told me. It's partly mine. Secondly, there is just a natural sense of fulfillment in work that an awful lot of people don't get to because of the way the system is structured now. And I could go on at length about examples, but I don't want to leave the impression that organized labor is unanimous on this. By all means, no. But I think we're seeing a new generation coming up the ladder that understands that the labor capital fights of the early 20th century produced rights for workers that didn't exist before and great eras of reform. But maybe, just maybe, Americans are now at a stage where we're ready for the next leap, which is what I think that would be.
Let's talk with some other listeners now. Next, we go to a caller on the toll-free line, line 4, listener in Belgium. Good afternoon.
Yes. I heard your guest just mention a couple moments ago about the average wage being high in the United States, and we all have to work very hard. I would like to point out that sometimes statistics kind of lie. And let's take this example. Mr. Gates, several years ago, was said to be worth several tens of billions of dollars. If he's only worth $50 billion today, and the average income in America is only $25,000, he himself brings the average of 2 million people who do zero up to the average. The disparity between the rich and the poor has gotten so large now that that kind of a thought, the average wage, really doesn't mean anything anymore, because the rich are just so rich and the poor are becoming so poor. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I quite agree with that, of course. And if I misspoke, the average wage, if you're talking about hourly worker wages in the United States, is not the highest by any means. It's surpassed by a number of European countries, and I think now Japan. If you go back to my last book on the global economy, you'll see I went through the real depression of U.S. wages, in the last, particularly in the last 20 years, for lots of reasons, including globalization. What I am talking about is that workers, Americans of all levels, are also consumers. And for the last 40 or 50 years, we have had, not unique but rare, an economy and society in which nearly everyone, except the very poor, could expand their consumption based on beyond the necessities. And we can argue over what are necessities, but I mean goods that are both recreational or have more variety or more quality, that have questions of comfort and taste that our ancestors would have been sort of shocked by, because the owning your own home was not the common experience in the first half of the 20th century for American families. Now it's up around 67-68% home ownership among American households. That expansion is threatened indeed by the inequality. And what we've seen in the last 20 years is sort of average working family, particularly if they're on hourly wages, losing that capacity for expansive consumption. And they're keeping up, sort of, but they're doing it in two ways they can't keep going. One is they're borrowing against their assets. They borrow down the equity in their homes, for instance. And we know about second mortgages and mortgage financing. Secondly, they're working longer. And typically that means more people in the same family getting jobs, maybe getting a second or third job. And particularly women came into the workforce in the last three decades in substantial numbers. I hope you get my point. You can do that, kind of hold off the inequities for 20 or 30 years and stay in the game, but you can't do it again in the next 20 or 30 years, because obviously the families can only have so much time to work longer, and sooner or later their savings base is gone.
Journalist William Greider, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's national affairs correspondent for The Nation. His latest book is The Soul of Capitalism, Opening Paths to a Moral Economy. Let's go on and talk with another listener. Listener in Charleston, line 1. Hi.
Yes, I want to get the spelling of, is it Greider or Greider?
Greider, G-R-E-I-D-E-R.
Okay, and the press that puts out your books are?
Simon & Schuster.
Simon, okay. I intend to get that.
Great.
I do have some comments. The capitalism, you know, as we know it, is, what, 200 years old? And the decay of it appears to me to indicate that the paradigm is worn out. And as the most of the world's 6 billion people live in abject poverty and want and starve to death and a whole bunch of other things that go along with the capitalist enterprises around the world. Recently on a program, a man gave the example of India, where Coca-Cola is damming off the Ganges and hoarding the water and then selling it back to people. Meanwhile, folks are dying for that prime necessity of life, water. And to be deprived of that, where you're already in a near feudal state of affairs, such as India is, where the upper classes own it all there, just like they do here. And how is it possible to fix that and to go to the next stage of human development, which is has to be steered by the working class, who have their self-interest in maintaining a job and a life around the world? You know, subsistence won't get it anywhere else in the world now. So, and as those places are more and more exploited into uselessness, where people still live, seems to me that the whole, I don't know if that's what you say in your book, but I've got to find out where you come down on that. But the thing is that it appears to be a horrendous sort of situation.
Yeah. I want to say first to Celeste, you have really interesting listeners.
Yeah.
Really terrific questions.
Good group.
And you know, grounded in some real thinking. I wrote a very long book that came out in 1997 called One World Ready or Not, The Manic Logic of Global Capitalism. And you might check out that book at the library, too, because it deals more directly with some of the stuff you're talking about in terms of the global inequities and the imperious globalization process and so forth. But in the United States, though the terms are not nearly so stark, we have a similar process underway where enterprises and finance are literally colonizing what we used to think were the common assets, like water, air, and so forth. It's less dramatic yet, but give us another 10 or 20 years, and we will see similar crises in this country, I think, over access to water and so on. But I want to go to your other question, which is how can you imagine getting control over this? Well, again, I'm going to put aside the global economy because I have spoken to that. But this new book tries to say to Americans, believe it or not, you can confront this, and you can confront it in terms that are familiar and close to you, not distant in Washington, D.C. or wherever. You are not as powerless as you may imagine. And I mean by that a kind of recognition that as workers, as investors, consumers, and of course as citizens who vote, collective action can begin to reach at some pretty obvious leverage points within the capitalist system itself and force change, not utopian, overnight apocalyptic change, but the kind of gradual building of popular leverage that is the way I think deep changes always happen in history, always have in the past. And you can tell from my tone, I am strangely optimistic. And part of the reason I am is because I've seen so many people around this country, and I describe a lot of them in the book, who are actually doing this now. Again, I will note, you don't read much about them in the newspaper unless they're kind of disparaged as crackpot pioneers. I happen to think they may be the future. I can't prove that they are, but I believe they are worth understanding. I'll give you some examples. The financial system, which is the commanding heights of the system and really the disciplinarian who pushes companies this way and that and corporate executives and everybody else, and sets the social contract in this country in some ways more directly than government and often more effectively. The when I say the social contract, I mean the fact that people are now working 12-hour shifts, and others are out of work and not able to even get a lowly job, and so on and so forth. Here's the paradox before us. The financial system of the United States, leaving aside the hundreds of billions it borrows from foreigners, operates on the money, the retirement savings of working Americans. And yes, alongside them are very wealthy individuals and institutions, and the inequalities among individuals are stark and growing starker. All that is true. Nevertheless, the center of gravity in American finance, the other people's money that Wall Street operates on, is the collectivized wealth of workers and employees. And it's housed in pension funds, it's housed in mutual funds, and a bunch of other fiduciary institutions that are supposed to invest that money in the long-term interests of the beneficial owners, that is, the future retirees. And that's the only thing they're supposed to invest in. And what I do in the book is sort of take that apart and demonstrate that that fiduciary obligation is really betrayed by the way the system works now. The capital savings of American workers are often, rather frequently in fact, invested in companies that turn around and damage those very people in all the ways we know. They are invested in the kind of short-term mentality of Wall Street brokerages, when in fact it's obvious the long-term interest of working Americans is patient capital that will husband and maintain not only jobs but communities and nature and on down the list. So what I'm suggesting is that there's a politics here that we need to get our heads into. And in a sense, it means taking responsibility for our own money. Some folks are doing that. They are described as marginal and kind of, you know, wishful thinking, blah, blah, blah. But the fact is they're getting some leverage. Now, I can go on and on in this way. Stop me, because I love this question. And I'm just trying to make real for people that I'm not just sitting here dreaming. I'm talking about action that is underway right now. And I freely admit that it's an uphill fight all the way, but it's not hopeless. And in fact, I'd write in the book, I reread it the other day looking for some fact. I predict that the values of Wall Street will be changed in the next 10 or 20 years fundamentally. And I know that sounds incautious, but I know where the levers of power are. And I see enough effort around the country of people to get a hold of those labors and those levers, and that includes everybody from church groups to labor unions, environmentalists, just plain vanilla citizens. I the logic of what they're doing is pretty powerful, and what we need to do is educate as broadly as we can, and that's kind of what I'm trying to do in this book.
I've got a couple of other listeners waiting, so I want to thank our caller in Charleston for joining us this afternoon. Next, we're going to go to a listener in Urbana on line two. Hi.
It'd be nice if retirement systems, which owns so much stock, and they could vote, show their preference against some of the worst excesses, that they don't take advantage of that. But at any rate, I had a couple of comments. One is that I want to point out that Jim Hightower is going around saying the same thing you are, that there's a lot of grassroots things going on.
Yep.
And another thing is that Arianna, one thing I think is really interesting is, and I didn't know, is something Arianna Huffington pointed out last year, that when in making the argument that market forces have no intrinsic moral direction, she points out that Adam Smith before he wrote The Wealth of Nations, wrote a book called The Theory of Moral Sentiments.
Right.
Because he understood that ethics had to precede economics, and we've lost all that.
I quite agree, and let me say about Jim, who's Hightower, who's an old friend. I have a website, let me say. It's called williamgreider.com. William Greider, one word, G-R-E-I-D-E-R.com. And I hope you'll check it out. It's got a lot of stuff about the book, but it has my rants and reflections on a whole bunch of other subjects. I just posted a piece yesterday congratulating Jim Hightower. His new book, which is Thieves in High Places, has hit the New York Times bestseller list. And this is really beating the gatekeepers, because Jim is a genuine grassroots leader. And he and I are kindred spirits, but I said in this web piece, our methods differ a little bit. Jim's style is to jump up out of the foxhole and fire grenades at the tank. And mine is more to sort of amble along in amiable conversation and scatter a few landmines. But we're both working the same territory. And your other point about Adam Smith is right. What's happened, particularly I would say in the last 30 years, but also earlier, is that economics as an orthodox profession, and frankly the leadership in business and finance, and a lot of ordinary Americans, have lost sight of the understanding that the economy is for the society, not the other way around. And what I'm trying to do, in a way, in this book, is to stand up and start that argument again, and to do it in a way that doesn't blow up capitalism. I don't think that's going to happen, or draw away from it and pretend that we don't benefit from its effective production and so forth. But to say, look, it doesn't have to be this way. And I guess what sets me apart from a lot of folks is I do have a lot of optimism about this country, and people think I'm naive or just incautious. Maybe I am, but I've as a reporter, you heard 40 years as a reporter, and I've seen this country and experienced it on a very personal level from top to bottom. And it does leave me with this feeling about Americans in general, not all of them, of course, but most of them are pretty smart, inventive, decent, generous, fun to be around people. And those that aren't completely beaten down with resignation and cynicism are capable of much more than the country gives them credit for.
Does the listener want to follow up?
Yeah, if I could. I just wanted to mention that that if you listen closely to Bush, you'll hear him lauding the efficiency of the market, but he never talks about the effectiveness.
That's right.
And that's the other shoe that has to drop.
Yeah.
You know? And one last thing, though. I'm not as optimistic as you, because and that was really my question is why do you have so much faith in democracy? Even the to my understanding, even the ancient Greeks realized that democracy tends to degenerate into plutocracy, you know, the rule of the rich, because people have this inordinate admiration for the rich, mm-hmm. and for wealth, and
do you feel that? You have that admiration?
No, but
neither do I.
But look around. Look around.
No, I know what you mean. I'm not quarreling with your point.
Okay.
That also is a great question. I will say I did write a book 10-12 years ago called Who Will Tell the People. And the subtitle was The Betrayal of American Democracy, and I described exactly what you're describing, which is the decay of our representative democracy. And it's got lots of reasons, and I focus particularly on the Washington dimensions of it, which are immense and pretty ugly, and it has not gotten better in the last 10 years after I wrote that book. Here's why I believe so much in democracy. It's essentially the story of people, whether they are well-educated and prosperous or whether they're struggling and ill-educated, people to realize themselves as human beings. And that's a very old story, and it's incomplete, to put it mildly. But it hasn't stopped, and I don't think it's going to stop. In American experience, it started at a very feeble level, remember. Only white men with property could vote for the first 20, 30 years. And we fought a civil war over expanding its meaning, and women didn't get the vote till 80 years ago. So we needn't be too self-congratulatory about our experiment. It is a transcendental story, however, I believe, and it's hard to do. But I think, particularly in our time, one of the deep alienating feelings that people have is that they know they are smarter, and just smarter about life and the world, not to mention their jobs and economics, than the system gives them credit for. And our politics is now dominated, and this happened in my lifetime, dominated by the same mass market manipulative techniques of commercial advertising. That's what campaigns are mostly about now. On the other hand, we've seen some many rebellions in the last few years, haven't we? Where people figured out how to get out from under that. And they didn't triumph exactly, but they took a whack at the system as is. I think we're seeing another one this year in the candidacy of Howard Dean. And I wish him well. I don't know who I'm going to vote for, but he looks like a man who figured out that most of the people aren't buying this stuff anymore. And if you'll just give them a little straight talk and a little sincere energy instead of taking polls and focus groups, maybe they'll respond. So don't give up on the process of democracy. I don't pretend for a moment that there was some perfect moment in the past, and I don't assume that this transcendental story will resolve in my lifetime. But I think this is what we have the capacity to do. And I know I'm talking too long, but I want to make one other point about democracy. In my book, I explain the authoritarian factory that we call the workplace. And note that the struggle for democracy, for a genuine representative democracy in this country, might start in the workplace rather than in elections. And I know various groups are working on that as well. It's a hard fight because it means we want to rearrange power in this society.
Before we have to wrap up here, which we now have to wrap up,
I'm sorry I talk so long, but your questions are so great.
Well, the listeners really raised a number of all kinds of great issues. I just wanted to go out here with the dedication of this book to a former colleague.
Yeah.
You say he lived in the spirit of Wendell Berry's dictum, "Be joyful, though you have considered all the facts." I really like that.
Yeah, it's. I hope people understand how not just comforting but inspiring that thought is. Keep your heads up. Be smart, but don't lose your idealism. That's what I think Americans are about. And some days it's hard to do that, I know. But I don't know. The book has a certain flavor of history to it because I am trying with little stories here and there to remind people the struggles that got us this far, and I'm not talking about government and wars and presidents. I'm talking about the ordinary folks of this country, white, black, and every ethnic persuasion, working on their own to get to where they could have a decent life and their family had some promise in their futures. And we can do that. I just believe we can.
Well, we're going to try and get Tracy Kidder on this program. His latest book is about a man whose philosophy is, well, you solve one problem so you can solve the next one.
Uh-huh.
And I look forward to that. It's about a man by the name of Farmer, and I forgive me, listeners, I can't recall it. But anyway, I like that idea. Be joyful, though you have considered all the facts.
Yeah.
William Greider, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you, Celeste. It was a wonderful hour for me.
William Greider's latest book is The Soul of Capitalism, Opening Paths to a Moral Economy. The publisher is Simon & Schuster. You've been listening to an interview from the AM 580 archives. You'll find interviews from the Afternoon Magazine and Focus 580 on our website. Visit WILL.UIUC.EDU.
I'm Todd Gleason, the host of the Closing Market Report, here with the settlement prices from the Chicago Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange this afternoon. A down day at the Board of Trade, with the exception of the nearby August contract in the bean pit, which was up 6.5 cents, but the rest of the contracts in the beans, the corn, and the wheat were all lower. That before tomorrow's release of the USDA crop production numbers from the United States and the World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates. Be sure to tune in tomorrow morning, by the way, to hear the first look at those at 8:49 at the pre-opening market report, and then again at 9:50 when we talk with Dan Zwick of AgriVisor Services in Normal, Illinois tomorrow. Of course, this afternoon in a few minutes, we'll talk with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services of Oakland, Illinois. He'll give us a primer on what that report might look like. Now, here are the numbers from the Board of Trade. 313.5 in the wheat pit for the September contract was the high for the day. The low at 304.5, a settlement price at 304.75. They were down 7.25 on the day. December contract, a 327.5 high, low at 318.75, a settlement price at 319.5, down 6.75, and the March wheat, 338.5 high, low at 331.25, and a settlement price at 331.5, 6.5 cents lower. May futures in the wheat pit, 344 the high, the low at 337, a settlement price there, 337.25, down 6.25, and July wheat for the day, 347 on the high, the low at 342, settled 342.25, down 4.75. September corn, 225.75 high, low at 220.5, settled 220.75, down 3.75, and December futures, 236.75 the high, the low at 231.25, a settlement price there, 232, they were down 3.75 for the day. From the March corn pit, 245 the high, the low at 239.5, March futures settled 240.25, 3.75 lower. In the May contract, 249.75 high, low at 245.5. A settlement for the May corn, 246, down 3.75. July futures, 255 to high, the low 5 cents below that at 250, and settled a penny above that at 251, down 3.5 for July corn of next year. And December futures, 2005 now, 260 the high, the low at 256.5. A settlement price at 257.75 for December 2005 corn, down 2.25 on the day. From the oat pit, the September futures at 135.5 on the high, the low at 130.25, settlement price at 130.75, they were off 3 cents for the day. And December oats at 142 high, low at 136.5, settled there 137.75, and they were down 2.5 cents for the day. Now the soy complex, the nearby August soybeans, which expire Friday of this week, by the way, settled the day 6.5 cents higher, but they were the only gainer in that pit. 642 the high, the low at 627. A settlement price at 637, and they were once again 6.5 cents higher in the August soybeans. Now, the September on out, a better reflection of what's actually happening with the new crop beans, 571 the high, low at 559.5, and a settlement price there, 561.5. They were down 10 cents for the day. November's soybeans, 565.5 the high, the low at 552. Settlement price there at 554.75, down 7.25. And the January's, 572 the high, the low at 558.5. Settlement price at 559.75. They were off 8 cents today. March beans, 579 the high, the low at 566. Settled 568, down 8.25. And November futures, 590 the high, the low at 580.5. A settlement price there at 581.75. And they were down 7.75 for the day. From the soy complex, the bean meal trading at 192.50 on the high side today for the nearby August contract. The low at 187.20, a settlement price at 188.30. They were off $9. And the September bean meal off 5.80 for the day. Had a high of 185.50, a low at 179.60, and a settlement price there at 181 even. Soybean oil for the day, 23.15 the high, the low at 22.55. Settled at 23.15. They were up 40 cents. And the September oil, A 22.25 high, the low at 21.90, settlement price there at 22.15, and they were up 3 cents for the day. Now from the Mercantile Exchange, here's how the numbers settled there for the day. August feeder cattle had a high of 115.60, a low at 114.25. They settled 114.42.5. Up 62.5 cents for the day. September futures 114.20 on the high, the low at 112.55, settled $112.72. They were up 92.5 cents for the day. October feeder cattle 95 cents lower at 113.55 on the high, the low at 111.90. A settlement price at 112.27.5. Once again, they were down 95 cents for the day. From the live cattle pit, the nearby August contract, 86.10, the high, the low at 84.25, a settlement price at $84.47.5. They were off 90 cents. And the October live cattle, 89.25, the high, the low at 87.20, a settlement price at 87.30. They finished the day $1.47.5 lower. Lean hogs now. The nearby contract trading the August at 78.40 on the high, the low at 77.45, settled 77.75. Once again, that settlement price at 77.75 and the nearby lean hogs. That's the August contract. They were down $1.07.5 for the day. October lean hogs 182.5 lower, 68.40 the high, the low at 66.85. And a settlement price at $67.02. December futures, 64.30 the high, the low at 62.95. Settlement price at 63.25. They were down 165 for the day. And the February lean hogs, $62.07 on the high, the low at 60.75. Settlement price at 61.57.5. They finished 87.5 cents lower for the day. And the pork bellies, $99 the high, low at 97.10, settled on that low, and they were down the $3 limit. I'll be back in just a few minutes with a look at the forecast and a promotion of what's happening during the closing market report when we'll talk with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services.
Agricultural information is made possible in part by a grant from the Archer Daniels Midland Company. ADM, the nature of what's to come.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's Ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Lee Blessing from Mankato, Minnesota writes, "Dear Dr. Science, what happens when a credit card expires?"
It helps the economy do the same. In fact, it's all these expiring credit cards that are giving our nation the economic willies. Our president has urged banks to issue credit cards that merely roll over and play dead every so often, but don't actually expire. So far, the banking industry has kept mum on the issue, but inside sources hint that the battle lines are being drawn for a showdown between Wall Street and Washington. A coup of convicted inside traders will attempt to use force to get released from country club minimum security prisons and install themselves in the White House. What I'm most worried about is if they succeed, no one will notice.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he